So our next speaker is Ms. Mary Homan. She is, Ms. Homan is the Mission Integration Coordinator and Chair of the Ethics Resource Group for the St. Francis Health Center Sisters of Charity Leavenworth Health System. That's a title. She has a master's in systematic theology and has done some doctoral public health coursework. And prior to joining Catholic Healthcare, she worked as a data and evaluation analyst for St. Louis University School of Public Health and the University of Missouri School of Medicine. And she's going to be speaking on immunizations and vaccine origins. What is a socially just public health response to ethical moral concerns? Ms. Homan, if you please.
So I'm sort of infamous for going not on time, so pardon me for keeping my timer up here. Good morning. My name is Mary Homan. I am trained as a Catholic theologian and healthcare ethicist. However, I am not here to represent the Catholic moral tradition, but want to show the alignment of public health principles regarding immunization practices in the United States with core biomedical principles that are undergirded by mainstream Christian thought. I have no financial relationships to disclose. Today's presentation will center around three major objectives: to identify the ethical issues surrounding immunization, to explain moral objections to certain CDC-recommended vaccines, to articulate public health's role in promoting vaccination coverage, with the application of the four biomedical principles of Beauchamp and Childress, and to equip public health professionals with tools of moral reasoning to bridge the gap between science and religious understandings of childhood vaccination. Healthy People 2010 set a 90% vaccination coverage level as, quote, sufficient to prevent the circulation of viruses and bacteria-causing vaccine-preventable diseases. Accordingly, all U.S. states require proof of immunization for school entry. As of January 1998, all states also allow medical exemptions, 48 states permit religious exemptions, 15 allow for philosophical and/or personal exemptions. Currently in the United States, anti-vaccination movements are making their voices heard. Some of this can be attributed to the increasing movement of people taking control of their health care and, in doing so, determining what procedures are necessary and ethical. One such example revolves around the use of vaccines derived from aborted fetal cell lines, particularly WI-38 and MRC-5. In the late 1950s, Hayflick and Moorhead began their work on cultures of human fetal fibroblast. Hayflick first reported in 1962 in the American Journal of Hygiene that human diploid cells could be used for tissue culture vaccine manufacture in relation to oral polio vaccines. Hayflick obtained embryos from surgical abortions of approximately 3 months gestation. Note, however, these abortions were not procured for the sake of the research or the development of vaccinations. Quote, the decision to abort was independent of the desire to make use of fetal tissue. In other words, the abortions would have taken place whether or not the cell line research followed, unquote. In response to the rubella epidemic that occurred in the United States from 1964 to 1965, Plotkin et al. Proposed that the growth of a rubella virus on human diploid cell strains ought to receive more attention. 5 years later, Dr. J.P. Jacobs of the Medical Research Council in the United Kingdom developed MRC-5, which essentially utilized the same technology developed by Hayflick, but at a different chemical value. From 1962 to 1965, during the rubella epidemic, an estimated 12.5 million cases of rubella occurred in the United States. There were 2,000 cases of encephalitis, 11,250 therapeutic or spontaneous abortions, 2,100 neonatal deaths. 20,000 infants were born with congenital rubella syndrome, with 11,600 suffering from deafness, 3,580 who were blind, and 1,800 cases of mental retardation. Following the vaccine licensure by 1970, the number of reported cases of congenital rubella syndrome in the United States had declined by 99%, from 77 cases in 1970 to one imported case in 2004. Let's turn our attention now to the main issue of immunizations and vaccine origin, and the question, what is a socially just public health response to moral, ethical concerns related to the use of vaccines derived from aborted fetal cell lines? Right to Life groups have advocated for religious exemptions to mandatory vaccinations because of the process used to originally obtain these cell lines. Such groups call for parents' moral obligation to refuse certain vaccinations for their children. Even as recently as Halloween, OneSimpleMama.com, a mother's website, and LifeSiteNews.com reported that if you have been vaccinated in the last 20 years, there is a 90% chance you have residual DNA from an electively aborted baby in your body. Alternatively, researchers affiliated with the National Immunization Program state that those parents who claim philosophical and/or religious exemptions may create some risk to the community because unvaccinated or undervaccinated persons may be a source of transmission. Let's take a look at the vaccines that are derived from aborted fetal cell lines. The column in the middle is taken from the website Children of God for Life, a Right to Life group in Florida. There are also vaccines listed in this column that are not FDA approved, but are approved for use in Canada and Australia. The column on the right is a list of federally contracted vaccines that contain those cell lines. One method for analyzing this ethical moral question is the four principles approach to biomedical ethics developed by Beecham and Childress in the 1970s. This approach recognizes four key principles that arose from reflections on common morality and the medical tradition: autonomy, non-maleficence, beneficence, and justice provide a simple, accessible, and culturally neutral approach to thinking about ethical issues in healthcare. The first principle, autonomy, emphasizes the personal responsibility we have for our own lives, to make our own decisions, to control what is done to ourselves. Autonomy includes the capacity to deliberate about a proposed course of action, as well as the ability to actualize it or carry it out. In America, where personal autonomy holds a special place among ethical values, many bristle at the thought of implementing medical interventions through government coercion. In a statement from June 5, 2005, the Roman Catholic Pontifical Academy for Life justified the use of the rubella vaccine because of the severity of the disease and conceded that the elimination of congenital rubella is a public health priority. The Pontifical Academy also asserted that the head of the family may make a reasonable, autonomous decision based on conscience not to vaccinate a child. However, the Academy observed that one can only do so without causing the children or the population to undergo significant risks to their health. The second principle, non-maleficence, imposes the obligation not to harm someone intentionally or directly. It is a reminder of the Hippocratic Oath, first, do no harm. A pregnant woman ought to make every effort to protect her baby from susceptibility potential birth defects. To minimize harm is a precept of the principle of non-maleficence. In 2009, Anakiva et al. Proposed that in the case of mandatory influenza vaccinations, non-maleficence may be interpreted to mean that healthcare workers are duty-bound not to place their patients at undue risk. Therefore, it would seem possible that a parent, recognizing that certain viruses, the effect that they have on an unborn fetus, would choose then to vaccinate their own child out of a duty to protect the unborn. The third principle, beneficence, may be described as the positive expression of non-maleficence. Beneficence can be seen as a way of ensuring reciprocity in our relationships. The argument is not simply the personal ethics of choosing to use a vaccine derived from aborted fetal cell lines. Rather, we must examine the concept that choosing not to vaccinate affects the community and ultimately puts the community at a higher risk for contracting dangerous, even fatal, diseases. The evident health benefits that must be considered are not just those of one's own children, but also those of the greater community to which those children belong. Beneficence engages a positive obligation to advance the health interests and welfares of others, to assist others in their choices to live life to the fullest. Looking at this graph, let's start with the horizontal axes and think about the disease severity associated with rubella. 12.5 million cases during a three-year epidemic. As you move right and you think about the trade-offs between autonomy and beneficence, it's clear the emphasis must be on beneficence. There is a high need to help those who are susceptible and unable to make choices on their own. Think of the 2,100 neonatal deaths associated with CRS in the early 1960s. In summary, this graph illustrates that when the risk of harm from disease is low, there's little need to help those who are susceptible. As the risk increases in terms of severity of the disease, the interest in intervening on their behalf, for example, by forcing them to receive a vaccination, rises along with it. The fourth principle of biomedical ethics is that of justice. As this year's conference theme is social justice, let's take a look at the logic of the principle of justice. At the individual level, justice is often equated with fairness or equity. However, from a Judeo-Christian background, another way to look at justice is from the perspective of the common good, where the common good is understood as the social conditions that allow people to reach their full human potential and to realize their human dignity. The principle of common good is the total of social living, not just the sum of individual goods. This implies then that individual citizens and intermediate groups are obligated to make their specific contributions to the common welfare. Following this logic, parents have a moral obligation to vaccinate their children because they cannot endanger the lives of others in the community. To reject these vaccines without satisfactory alternatives would be to expose our families and society to unacceptable disease risk. This then moves us back to the question of the presentation. What is a socially just public health response to ethical, moral concerns of utilizing vaccines derived from aborted fetal cell lines? Because we live in community, we do not simply choose what suits us best, but we must be aware of the larger implications of our decisions. The success of public health relies on individuals recognizing the value of community as interest as well as self-interest. It becomes easier to overlook the value of individual vaccination when there is little evidence that the real or perceived risk to our children or ourselves has a tangible benefit. Therefore, it is the responsibility of public health professionals to translate and disseminate scientific and ethical aspects of vaccine development and immunization practices to the general public, legislators, religious groups, healthcare providers. To be able to share readily available statistics and figures that are reasonably understandable to ordinary people. To be candid about the risks and the benefits of immunization. To understand and respect the religious beliefs underlying immunization issues, and to engage public groups in ethical dialogue. Similarly, it is the responsibility of healthcare providers to supply accurate information so parents and guardians may make informed decisions, to be candid about the risks and the benefits surrounding immunization, to notify patients and their decision makers of the vaccine's components, to have readily available statistics and figures that are reasonably understandable to ordinary people, to understand and respect the religious beliefs underlying the issue. Justice implies that all participate in the common good. Therefore, it is the responsibility of parents and guardians to seek accurate information from medically appropriate sources, to ask a physician about the vaccine, its side effects, its components, to understand what their own religious tradition actually teaches about the issue, and to encourage the development of ethical vaccines. To vaccinate does not take for granted the life of the aborted fetus, nor make it a means to an end. Because, quote, the three abortions were not conducted for the purpose of harvesting the cell lines or the virus, unquote. Whereas objecting to a vaccine places a whole community under threat of infection, especially the unborn. No further harm is generated by the use of these vaccines, nor, more importantly, no obvious good is achieved by refusing it. It is of greater concern that individuals practice vaccination, since appropriate vaccination has led to the eradication of such terribly destructive diseases, such as smallpox. An individual can benefit from an unjust or an immoral act without approving of or cooperating with that act. Ethicists at the National Catholic Bioethics Center concluded that the association between certain vaccines and abortion was non-complicit, and that using these vaccines is not contrary to a principled opposition to abortion. For those who argue that the use of these vaccines makes one complicit with the act of the abortion, Christian moral tradition states, an action that is conjoined to, but does not intend, a particular immoral act may be justifiable if it is sufficiently remote. In sum, appropriate and on-time vaccinations are necessary because, as the late Pope John Paul II put it, society has the right and the duty to protect itself. Thank you.
One down there and then over there.
My question is, what happens in the case of an emerging disease outbreak and there are certain groups that refuse to take the vaccine at the moment?
So what would be the response of public health professionals in that regard? I think it is the responsibility. I've been on both sides of being the scientist and being a theologian, and I think it's so important to really get to the heart of what the issue is. We talk a lot about cultural competency, but we don't often talk about the religious competency associated with it. I think we need to meet people where they are, not browbeat them with science, but be able to say, what's your tradition saying about this? How do you feel about this? What greater good will come of not participating in this intervention, in this treatment, in this quarantine, or whatever it is? And at some point, I think that is the importance of having public health law trump in certain extraneous cases where it will put everyone at risk. So if it means having to quarantine a whole community, which we have seen, especially with Christian Scientist communities, of quarantine whole communities, then I think that is the prerogative of public health, but not passing judgment on those folks for what the religious tradition is saying.
For those who provide aborted fetal lines for vaccine production, do those who provide it obtain financial benefit of providing those lines?
I think that...
in other words, are manufacturers paying for those tissue lines for those vaccines?
They are, in certain extents, but usually they've been warehoused within two of the major pharmaceutical and vaccine companies. As you could see, the majority of them were from Merck and GlaxoSmithKline. So they own the rights to those. That being said, there is a recent patent pending for new fetal tissue for vaccine development because of the attenuation of those cell lines. But one would argue from a Christian moral tradition that is a sufficiently remote, and therefore it is immaterial remote cooperation with that evil. Does that?
But it does begin to sort of challenge that assumption that, mm-hmm. there is no connection to the ultimate use. I mean, I can create a scenario that's very similar to this where a death is going to occur anyway, but we're going to get a financial benefit from producing that death by selling off organs for trade.
And that's a good example. That was what one of the examples was in the paper was about organ donation. And being an ethicist, I have that experience being down in the ICU and a family having to make a decision. Do we decide to donate organs? And what does that mean? What good comes of that? And again, that results in I didn't participate, the physicians did not participate in the condition that patient arrives in our ICU. And it is of greater good if they are a healthy person to take those organs and be able to transplant them in someone else because we did not participate, but the evil, the damage occurred elsewhere.
I think the challenge, though, is that that's distinct, is the particulars aren't consistent.
Right.
Particulars of a particular instance is a non-systematic approach, whereas abortion tends to operate in a systematic function, particularly with large abortion providers. Mm-hmm. I think there can be a connection made, whether remote or not, that there is financial incentive for abortion providers to supply these organs. Mm-hmm. I think that we can't say there's no connection.
The WI-38 and MRC-5 are from 1962, in that era, so they've not continued to abort to get those cell lines. And maybe that's to be, so that there is further research, but these two cell lines which exist and these vaccines don't have to keep repeating to in order to acquire those lines.
Kirk.
Then would you see a difference in a case such as, let's think a little bit about embryonic stem cell research and scenarios where there'd be a considerable demand for mm-hmm. more embryos or generating mm-hmm. things. Would you see a distinction between that scenario and the scenario in which there's
exactly. It is formal material cooperation in that regard, and the Pontifical Academy for Life, as well as the National Catholic Center for Bioethics, have come out pretty adamantly when the intentionality is the destruction of the embryo in order to continue research, no matter how good it is, that's what it is. And it sounds like a fine line, but it's the immediate of, I'm walking into the lab today knowing I will destroy this embryo in order to achieve this greater good, whereas I continue to produce this vaccine from this act that happened 40 years ago. You know, that there is an important distinction as far as ethics is concerned.
One last question.
Right. Thank you.